tonight is anniversary night. The format of tonight's meeting will be a main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our information break and the anniversary celebrants. Our main speaker tonight is Charlie.
I'm Charlie Hill. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. See, I thought I had like a half an hour or something, you know, to listen to some other speakers. So I guess I haven't had time to make up a story. I'll just tell you the truth. I'm so glad to be here. I'm very happy to be here. I've never been to New York. This is my first trip to New York. Yeah, thank you, thank you. Yeah. So, I really feel like I should have been here a long time ago because I grew up in Las Vegas, and about half the people I knew were all from New York. And we lived in Boca Raton, Florida, which is New York South. But I think I've had the entire experience of New York already. We left the airport, took a cab to the hotel. The guy stole $20 off me. And then I went and got pizza. And everybody it's been driving me crazy. All my friends from New York say, oh, you got to have New York pizza. You got to have New York pizza. And it's been, so I was really hoping that it would suck. But it didn't. I got to tell you, they're right. You know, New York pizza is probably the best I ever had. But my sobriety date is November 19th, 1979. Well, thank you. Thank you, both of you. And my sponsor's name is Clancy. That's why I'm wearing this tie. I got this Clancy starter outfit on. And my home group is the Searchlight Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's near Las Vegas, Nevada. We live in Henderson now, Irene and I, my sweetheart. And she's one of the promises. But we live on the edge of Henderson, and my home group is Searchlight, Nevada. Searchlight, Nevada has 500 people that live there. And so this is a bit overwhelming. There are five people that are in the group there. It's definitely small town Alcoholics Anonymous. If you have a problem with somebody, too bad. The meeting was formed about 30 years ago by a guy who went there and got sober. And he, as far as I'm concerned, is a pillar of Alcoholics Anonymous because his sponsor told him since there was no meeting there, he needed to start one. So we started a meeting on Wednesday night, and him and his sponsor would sit there and they would read the book and make a pot of coffee and wait for an hour, and then at the end of that meeting, pack up and go home. And now there's anywhere from 20 to 50 people there every Wednesday night. And they come from all over, and they're people that are willing to drive 30, 35 miles or 40 or 50 or 70 to go support a meeting. And there's a weird thing that happens as a result of that, is that the length of time in this meeting is ridiculous. We had three birthdays a couple weeks ago, two 50s and a 37. And then the following week, we had a 52 and a 41. So what we're thinking of doing is just instituting a thing where we go, are there any newcomers with less than 30 years that would like to introduce themselves? You know, please feel free to do so. So usually what I do is I break my talk into three parts, what I was like and what happened when I'm like now. So I think you get about 5 minutes of each because I blew all that time talking about my sponsor and my home group. But here goes. I was born in Compton, California, and then moved to Chino. My dad was geographically challenged. And then we wound up in Las Vegas, Nevada, but we were very broke. We were poor. We weren't broke. We were poor. We lived in my uncle's homestead, which is a little shack that you build. If you build it and you live there for 5 years, they give you the 5 acres around it. So my uncle, who got sober and Alcoholics Anonymous in 1952, had this homestead with no interior walls, no plumbing, no lights, you know, nothing. And my dad had to go to him and ask him if he could put his family in there. I imagine that was pretty tough. My mom met Elsa and Chuck Chamberlain in 1947, 1948. She was trying to get my dad sober, and it never took. My dad came here, and he made fun of Alcoholics Anonymous. He would come home and talk to us about how poor old Bob's so drunk again and they're all tore up. And he was too slick. and he died drunk. He died across the street from the Salvation Army Yard in North Las Vegas, Nevada, where him and another drunk would fix furniture and toys and get enough money for a bottle and go back and drink. And I can't imagine, you know, he died before I got sober, so we never got to come to terms or any kind of amends or anything. But I always imagine now what it must have felt like to go to his brother and ask if he could put up his family in that little shack. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with it because I was just a kid and it was kind of an adventure to live out in the middle of the desert. Went to school, I felt different, and which is, I've heard it from the podium a lot. And everybody I sponsor seems to have the same problem. They just felt a little bit different, and I felt a little bit different. I just had this feeling inside, just like I was just a nervous kid. And I was always trying to figure out how to act. And we moved from that place to a very rough neighborhood in Las Vegas, a place off Donna Street, which has actually been on National Geographic for gangs. And I wasn't tough, so I played the crazy card, which worked. I found that people are reluctant to beat you up if you act crazy. So that's what I did. So I got through high school. I was in high school for a long time. I demonstrated all the alcoholic traits. I was in high school for 6 years. I got a junior pregnant when I was a senior, and back then they didn't have any baby mamas, so you married them. And so I came back to high school as a divorcee. So I finished my high school, the divorcee. It wasn't a big deal in my high school. You know, we had daycare. But I got out of high school and married another girl out of that high school, got in trouble with the law, wound up in the Army. Back then, it was kind of a choice they would give you. If it wasn't too bad a crime, you could go in the Army instead of doing your time. So I went in the Army and got out of the Army, went back to Las Vegas, and became a crap dealer. Now, I'm not swearing. I know there's this thing about swearing. Just want to let you know, a crap dealer is a croupier. He's a dice dealer. I want to explain that. I don't want you to think I was a manure salesman when I say I was a crap dealer, you know. But it was a great job for a drunk because everybody drank. The players drank, the bosses drank, you drank. I made nothing but money, and it was just a great occupation for an alcoholic, and it got me here very quickly. It got me here very quickly. By the time I was 31, which is when I got here, I only have enough saliva for like 8 minutes. When I got here, I was 31 years old. I was on wife number 3, part-time. And I was a crap dealer, and I had a bunch of money but no furniture. I had a beautiful apartment with nothing in it. I had to become my dad. I always said I never wanted to be anything like my dad. I became just like him. And I could just boil it down for you that I qualify to be here. I absolutely qualify to be here. I can remember towards the end of my drinking, I went to somebody's house, a normal person's house, and me and some other people, and we were going to go out to the discos because I'm old. And I was feeling sick. And alcoholics know when they're going to be sick. And amateurs, non-alcoholics don't have any idea when they're going to throw up. But alcoholics know. And I'm sitting there, I'm getting a little queasy, and I said, excuse me, I need to go to the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom, and I'm throwing up in this toilet. And I'm just really having at it. You know, I'm just one of those things that make the Al-Anons go start cheering. You know, just like, I'm holding on to the toilet bowl. And I'm looking around in there, and there's all these unsightly stains. And I'm thinking, what a pig this woman is. My head's in her toilet. I think she's a pig. If you come to my house today, you'll find a spotless toilet. I belong here. I belong here because you understand me and other people don't. Other people don't understand alcoholics. And they love us and they try to help us, but they really don't understand us. Because we don't have a plausible answer either. Towards my last drink, I was getting ready to have my kids for Christmas, which is odd because I didn't get my kids for Christmas. I was the dad who other people were raising my kids, and for once I was going to get my kids for Christmas, and I was so happy to have them for Christmas, and I stayed sober for 14 days, and then on Christmas Eve I took a drink of Scotch whiskey because I was all tightened up about putting those toys together, and I don't remember Christmas. I blew off Christmas and New Year's, and it took a long time before those kids would talk to me again. And I remember people later on asked me, why would you do something like that? Why would you take that drink of scotch just at the worst possible moment? Your kids are coming over to be with you, first time ever. Why would you drink? And the truth is, I don't know. I don't know. So when I got in here, I was pretty beat up. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas. It's a great place to get sober because we have meetings around the clock. My sponsor at the time was Dick Toussaint, and he passed away a couple of years ago. Dick Toussaint was a great guy. He was a great guy to sponsor me because I would ask him about the steps, and I wanted him to take me through the steps. And he said, if you want to do the steps, then you go find yourself a meeting that deals with those steps, and you you listen up. You know. So somebody says, does somebody have a topic, and you're on step four? Say, yeah, I have a topic, step four. And the first time I did that, somebody said, well, would you like to share? And I had to ask Dick the next day, what do I say? He said, don't say nothing. Tell them you want to hear about step four and let them talk and get some hints on how to do it. And I did all those steps with Dick Toussaint. Not once did he sit down with the book with me and go through it as is so popular today, as I do it today. So I went and got the program because I desperately wanted it. I was so messed up. I was so sick. And I made it 6 months, went out, took a drink, got back in, made it another 6 months. And I had a chance to go to Idaho. I was a pit boss in a casino in Las Vegas. And I had a chance to go to Idaho to go into the mining business and to be an underground miner. And so I went to my sponsor, Dick, and I said, Dick, I got this chance to go to Idaho and be a miner. And I thought he would say, no big changes in your first year. You're only 6 months sober. Instead, he said, do you know anybody in Idaho? And I said, no, I don't. He said, you should go to Idaho. And he sent me to Idaho. I went to Idaho, and there weren't very many meetings. And that really was the beginning of my sobriety. Now, the way that my sobriety works today, kind of what happened there. There weren't very many meetings. The meetings I went to had 10 or 12 people in them. The first meeting I went to, I got into a big beef with the only other guy there. There was one guy there. I go to this meeting and we get in a beef, and but he gave me five cassette tapes, and those five cassette tapes were Norm Alpe, Johnny Harris, Clancy, Sybil Corwin, and Chuck Chamberlain, and I would go everywhere in Idaho. Everywhere is a long way from anywhere in Idaho, so everywhere I would drive, I would listen to those five cassettes over and over and over, and that was my foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the group, the Pacific Group, had no idea the effect that they had on me. I don't take myself seriously at all. If you get to know me, you'll find that's true. But I take this very seriously because I'm up in the wilds of Idaho, and my connection was those guys talking at their home group about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that they didn't get up and they didn't, what can I say? I don't ever want to embarrass Alcoholics Anonymous in the podium, and I don't ever want to come up here and try to come off like I know something about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just another bozo on the bus. I'm just a lucky, lucky, lucky guy that got sober and got to stay sober this long. I'm not an authority. And I'm one drink away from having the newest guy in the room as a sponsor. And I got to remember that. And as far as importance, the first time I got to talk, I was so proud of it. I was proud of it. I was, because they asked me to talk. And I remember after the talk, I was asking Dick how I did, and he said, let me ask you a question. He said, if you didn't show up, what would happen? And I said, well, they'll find somebody else with a tie. Todd's got a tie. He could do it. And the meeting would go on fine. He said, what would happen if the coffee maker didn't show up? That's a lot more serious. So speaker, coffee maker, you know. I just can't take it too seriously, but I do take what I say seriously, and I can tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous absolutely saved my life. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have given me an existence that, like, I never believed. I couldn't leave Las Vegas until I got sober. Once I got sober, I realized that I could go anywhere I wanted to as long as I didn't pick up a drink, and so I did. Irene and I have been very fortunate. I met Irene after I went to Idaho and got rich. It was not a good thing for a guy like me. I made a bunch of money in a very short period of time. And bought an airplane, and I was a joy to the program. I would fly to meetings and let everybody know I flew there. And then I lost all the money, because that's kind of how mining is. And then next thing you know, I moved to Reno, Nevada, and I'm living in somebody else's car, and I got 3 years sober. And I start going to meetings there. The marriage didn't last. I met the lovely Irene, and we've been together 31 years now. But she and I went from there to Auburn, California, and we're sitting there, and we're doing, and the way we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous, the way we both do, she's got 27 years sober, and we've been together 31 years now. So she wasn't an alcoholic when I met her. It's a sexually transmitted disease. A lot of people don't know that. Anyway, so what we would do is we kept moving, and we moved on purpose. We didn't move as geographics. We moved because we wanted to move. We moved to Auburn, California, and we're sitting there, and all our friends are going on vacation. And we're very active in the program. We would move to a town, and then we would discover they weren't doing it right. They never do it right. And then I would go to meetings, and I'd call my sponsor back home and try to stay sober on that. And my sponsor said, you've got to get in where you are and talk to newcomers and visitors and have a fellowship grow up around you where you are. You can't stay sober on what you did back there. So we do that. So we're sitting in Auburn, and we wanted to go on vacation, and we didn't have any money. But we had terrible jobs. And Irene said, you know, I bet they have terrible jobs in beautiful places. So we made a conscious decision in Alcoholics Anonymous that we would move to beautiful places and just go to work. So the way it works is this. We go to a beautiful place. We find a meeting, a job, and a place to live, just about in that order, and we would live there. We'd live there usually 3.5-4 years, and when we got there, we would just like a bomb. We would come in, and if it's a resort area, we would go around and make sure that the visitors knew where the AA meeting was. We would offer in transportation to the meetings. We would start, when new guys would come in, we would just leap on them. We would have things at our houses, and we would let a fellowship go up around us. And then when we moved, it was like, you know, we left a sponsorship bomb or something. So these little pockets of enthusiasm. And by doing that, we moved from Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. Well, first thing we did is in Auburn, we moved to Sedona, Arizona. I don't know if anybody's been there, but we moved to Sedona, Arizona. We had never been there. We saw a postcard. One of my sponsees sent us a postcard, and we're looking at it. And Irene goes, is it that pretty? And the guy goes, yeah, make your eyes water. I said, okay. So we moved to Sedona. And when we got there, they didn't do it right. And we just jumped into the meetings and did what we're supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then a fellowship grew up around us, and we went on vacation to Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. And we looked around for about 10 minutes and went back and had a garage sale and moved to Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, sober. And I just had a wonderful time. And the meetings there were great because people would show up. A lot of people go to Cabo San Lucas and Cancun and places like that and never hit a meeting. And I can tell you, in all those places, there are pockets of people that are just dying for you to show up and say hi. And what we would do is we would have these meetings, and when the visitors would introduce themselves, we would leap on them and say, where are you staying? Can we take you to a meeting? You know? We still have, I have a phone, but my phone is full of numbers of people that we've met like that. And while we were in Cabo San Lucas, we went to Sisters in Bend, Oregon, which is a very pretty spot. And we decided that was pretty nice, and we moved there, and we lived there for about 4 years, but very cold. And we were on vacation in Boca Raton, Florida, one January, and we looked around, and there was an apartment for rent. We thought it was a sign from God. So we rented this apartment in Boca Raton and did the same thing. Just jumped into the program there, and we've never had a regret for doing what we've done. And when we were there, I got a job offer back in Cabo San Lucas, and we went to Todos Santos, Mexico, which is a sleepy little town, has one stoplight, 5 members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the group, and 6 meetings a week. We were going to, one time, everybody was just going to tell the story of the person on their left. You know. So. And then in November of 2007, my mom called me up. She says, your sister has a week to live. My sister is who 12-stepped me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I said, well, let's load up and go. So Irene and I jumped in the truck, and off we went to Las Vegas, and my sister died on the 4th of December of 2007. And so my mom, while she was watching her daughter die, her husband got sick. Her husband she was married to for about 34 years. And he went into the hospital and got MRSA and died on the 20th of December. So all of a sudden we're sitting there, and here's my little 82-year-old mom, and she just buried her daughter and her husband. So we stayed, and now we live there. And we stayed there, and we're doing a living amends. And what we're doing is we live with my mom. We've got her on the camera right now, and we take care of her. And we'll be there until she passes. So kind of a race. She's pretty healthy. But we did the same thing there. And we want to make sure that we let the visitors know that come to Las Vegas, that when they come to Las Vegas, we jump on them. There's some people here that have come to Las Vegas, and if you've seen me, we've leapt on you. And the reason is because you never know why somebody's there. When we came to Las Vegas as visitors, everybody assumes that when people come to Vegas as a visitor that they're there for some visity thing. You know, they're there for a wedding or there for something else. And a lot of times they're there to put a family member into a home, or in our case, we were burying half of our family. And to have somebody come up and say, when you're a visitor, I just make sure in my home group that no visitors go without getting a handshake. The newcomer is very important. But there's a demographic in Alcoholics Anonymous that is in danger, and that's the visitor that is relocating. And they're relocating because they want to be in this new place, but they don't think the AA is quite like it was back home, and it never is. And I need to grab those people. I need to grab. I'm not saying you do. You can do whatever you want. I don't sponsor anybody in this room. Not yet. I can tell you one thing, is that I don't like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think if you like everybody in AA, you're just not going to enough meetings. I am way too happy for a lot of people. I'm like a cheerleader for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like the golden Labrador of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you come in here shaking, I welcome home. You know, I'm so glad you're here. And it doesn't fit with everybody. There's different kinds of sobriety. So not everybody likes me, and I don't like everybody. But I love each and every one of you. I love each and every one of you. Because you know me. And you know me like nobody else does. I puked in my pants once. I was sitting on the toilet. When it happened. Now, if I told that at the Board of Realtors, they would be disgusted. But I tell that in here, and I get laughter, and I saw some heads going like, yeah, I can see that happening. You know? And I sincerely wish that was the worst thing I ever did in my pants. I really do. But you people know me, and nobody else does. Not like we know each other. Not like we know each other. I love each and every one of you. There's nothing you can do about that. And what that means is, even if I don't like your delivery, and you call me up at 2 in the morning and say, Charlie, I'm thinking about taking a drink. Would you come and talk to me? I would come talk to you. And I believe, whether you like my pitch or not, that if I called you up and said, I'm thinking about drinking,